Okay, so it's common for moral philosophers to reject a moral theory on the basis that its verdicts are unreasonably demanding. And I think that's quite correct. There can be convincing demandingness objections to moral theories. Consequentialists are most frequently faced with such demandingness objections to their theory, but it's not obvious why consequentialism should be peculiarly vulnerable to these objections, and that's one of the things that I'm going to say something about. So I've put a formulation of one version of consequentialism on the handout. This is what we might call maximising act consequentialism, or MC, as I will keep referring to it. So it says that we're morally obliged to bring about the best consequences we can, impartially considered, or perhaps the best expected consequences we can. And any alternative action is morally wrong. Right, now that claim is extremely counterintuitive, I think. And there are different ways of bringing that out that fall under the heading of demandingness objections. So I've listed four of these. So first of all, MC seems to rule out the intuitive availability of a variety of morally permissible courses of action on any given occasion. So when I'm deciding what to do this Sunday, I generally think that there are very many things that I could do that are not morally wrong. So I could go to the zoo, I could have a picnic, I could mark some exam scripts, I could travel to Paris, I could go and visit my family. Any of these things would be morally permissible. MC seems to imply, by contrast, that there's one thing that I ought to do this Sunday that is whatever will bring about the best consequences, or perhaps the best expected consequences that I can. If I do any of the others, then I'm acting morally wrongly. Now, of course, it might be the case that under certain circumstances, by happy accident, there's going to be more than one action that has the best consequences, has the joint best consequences, or the joint best expectable consequences, perhaps. And so then I have a moral permission to perform one of those actions on lucky days, if you like. So that seems very counterintuitive. Not only does MC imply that there are very few morally permissible actions or lifestyles in general available to me, it seems that the lifestyles that I'm permitted to live are pretty unattractive ones. Given the empirical state of the world, where there's so much preventable suffering, so many poor people with curable or preventable illnesses, it seems that if such an impartialist consequentialism is correct, then each of us is morally required to give up virtually all of our spare time and money to helping the world's worst off. So even though there are many more appealing ways to spend my spare time than devoting myself to helping very poor people, I'm morally forbidden from pursuing any of these options, since they won't maximise the goods. So we act wrongly, according to MC, if we spend any significant amount of time living our own lives, pursuing our own goals, enjoying close personal relationships. We're only permitted to do as much of these things as is necessary to keep ourselves healthy and sane enough to keep on maximising the good over the long term. So it's deeply counterintuitive to say that this life of extreme and unrelenting altruism is the only permissible one available to us. Okay, secondly, MC seems to condemn morally admirable behaviour. So if you consider someone who brings about very large amounts of good, devotes most of her spare time and money and efforts to helping the worst off, but does less than the most she possibly can, then by the lights of MC, she's acting morally wrongly. And that strikes most of us as an extremely implausible implication of MC. That person's acting in a way that's extremely morally admirable, even though they're falling short of the very best they could do in terms of producing the impartial good. Very closely connected with that is number three. There seems to be a category of supererogatory action, whatever that entails. So action that's morally good, perhaps, but goes beyond the call of duty, that's optional. Perhaps action that's especially admirable. And we usually think of that as a real distinct category of actions. But MC seems to deny that, since it claims that one is morally required to do the best or the morally best thing that one can do, leaving no space for the supererogatory. So if you have a scale of possible actions from best to worst, where the best action is the one that brings about the best consequences, the most impartial good, and then the second best is the one that brings about the next most impartial good, and so on down to the worst action that brings about the worst consequences, then MC seems to imply that in order to be acting morally permissibly, you've got to perform the action right at the top of that ranking or scale. So there's no category of actions near the top of the scale that we would call supererogatory. Okay, and then fourthly, MC doesn't seem to allow partiality towards yourself or your loved ones beyond that which is mandated in an impartial calculus. So you can only favour your own children, for example, to the extent that doing so is a necessary part of maximising overall well-being. There's lots more to be said about that, but I won't say any more just now. So together, those worries, those four worries, constitute an apparently strong demandingness objection to MC. And I think they are pretty conclusive objections to that that view of maximising act consequentialism. And it's natural to justify the rejection of MC on the basis that it makes unreasonably high demands of moral agents. So we're not morally obliged to completely devote our lives to helping the worst off. We don't act morally wrongly just in virtue of doing less than what is impartially optimal. So MC is simply too demanding to be plausible. Okay, now demandingness objections have recently come under attack, and that's what I'm going to come to in the third section. But before moving on to attacks on demandingness objections, I want to say a little bit about why consequentialism has been thought peculiarly vulnerable to demandingness objections. What is it about consequentialism that's so different from other moral theories such that it gets the brunt of these objections? So people often think of consequentialism as being the demanding moral theory par excellence, and they think of Peter Singer, who's a consequentialist, as being the poster boy for a demanding morality. But interestingly, in Peter Singer's most famous article, Famine, Affluence and Morality, he doesn't presuppose consequentialism in formulating his impetus for a very demanding morality. Instead, he proposes a weaker moral principle, which is plausibly part of common sense morality, i.e. a non-consequentialist morality, but which nevertheless threatens to generate extreme demands. So I've put this on the handout. So Singer's principle is, he's actually got two, but one of them says, when we can prevent a serious harm without risking something of moral significance to ourselves, we are morally obliged to do so. And that's something that many moral theories, consequentialist or otherwise, would be tempted to sign up to. But we appear to be consistently in a position, Singer urges, where we can prevent serious harm without risking something of moral significance to ourselves. We can help some of the distant poor, relieving significant suffering and saving lives at little cost to ourselves. Okay, so why is it then that consequentialism has been subjected to demandingness objections so much more than other theories? Well, I think one simple reason is that it seems to provide relatively clear verdicts on what our moral obligations are. So the version of consequentialism which consists just in the assertion of MC, the claim I've put on the handout, offers a clear, precise criterion of moral obligation, in principle at least. And it's pretty clear that MC's verdicts will, given the state of the world, be very demanding on an agent. Other theories just tend not to be so clear in their verdicts as to what we've got to do, particularly by way of duties of beneficence. So many Kantians, virtue ethicists, contractualists, particularists and so on, are relatively cagey about how demanding their theories are. We're going to be hearing about Kantian imperfect obligations later today, which I'm looking forward to. Do we need to be discharging our imperfect obligations continuously, or at least when there's not a perfect obligation in play? Well, if so, then a Kantian morality threatens to be just as demanding as many people take consequentialism to be. I'll leave those difficult questions for Alice later. So other moral theories typically don't offer such a clear criterion of what we're morally obliged to do, even in principle, to help those less well-off than ourselves. And I don't intend that as a criticism. In fact, I think it's a virtue of a theory, because I think there is no such clear criterion of what we're required to do to help those less well-off than ourselves. Insofar as they do tell us what we're obliged to do, other moral theories often tend to stick closer in their verdicts to common sense morality, which isn't so demanding on us, or at least not obviously. So according to common sense morality, there are certain things that we must do and must not do. The main things that we must not do is harm other people, free ride and cheat. And the things we must positively do is keep our promises and fulfil our undertakings more generally. And perhaps do some sort of minimal amount in order to help people who are less well off than ourselves. Which is not going to be too demanding because it's minimal. So that common sense theory of morality, very crudely expressed in about four sentences, is relatively undemanding. So there may be some circumstances in which it can be demanding, but it's not going to be relentlessly demanding in the way that MC threatens to be. It's not the case that there's something I must be doing all the time. It's not the case that I have no time and space for my own projects and relationships beyond those which happen to be a necessary means to maximising the impartial good. So moral theories which model their account of moral obligations on our ordinary judgments of common sense morality will not end up being extremely demanding like MC seems to be. Right. Secondly, in considering these non-consequentialist moralities that I've been talking about, I've been talking about what they require or demand of us. But moral theories need not only provide a criterion of what's morally required or demanded or obligatory. They can and should also provide a ranking of actions from morally best down to what's morally worst. And consequentialism is well understood as providing such a ranking. It's very naturally understood that way. But non-consequentialist theories, if they are to provide as full an account of the moral as consequentialist theories, ought to be doing the same sort of thing. So if non-consequentialist theories have a less demanding account of moral obligation than consequentialist ones are generally thought to do, what do these other theories say about lifestyles which go the extra mile, which go above and beyond what duty requires? Lifestyles which involve greater devotion to the prevention of suffering to others in poor countries, for example, than one which just fulfills the requirements of morality and no more. Well, I think common sense deontological morality would say that it's fine, it's okay to live the minimally moral life where you just fulfill your moral requirements and no more, but that it's even better to live a life that better promotes the impartial good, at least within moral constraints. So a life that does more to help those who are less well off than yourselves. So it might be too much to demand that we all live a life like Mother Teresa, or devote all of our spare time and resources and efforts to helping the poor, or campaigning for trade justice, or for environmental action. But people who do these sorts of things, or spend vast amounts of time doing those sorts of things, are doing even better than those who just fulfil their moral obligations and no more. So he's a better man than me, we might say, of someone who's living this lifestyle of extreme altruism or do-gooding. So if that's right, then the ranking of actions that common sense morality, or that deontological moralities in general, will offer, doesn't seem so very different from the consequentialist ranking. As with a consequentialist ranking of actions, at the top of common sense deontological morality's ranking of actions will be those which involve extreme altruism or self-sacrifice. But why should the theories be so different in terms of their vulnerability to demandingness objections in that case, given that both put at the top of their rankings, i.e. give their strongest endorsement to, very demanding self-sacrificial lifestyles and actions? Well, it's just because traditionally consequentialism, at least in its modern versions, has included the idea that only the best is good enough, so what we might call a presumption of optimality. But why should that be so? Why should a consequentialist ranking of actions, in particular, be tethered to the idea that only the best is good enough, in a way that alternative non-consequentialist rankings are not? There seems to be no good reason for this. So my contention is that theories will be vulnerable to demandingness objections if they make two sorts of claims. So I've put this on the handout. This is the third section from the bottom on page one. So any theory is going to be vulnerable to demandingness objections if it claims, firstly, that considerations grounded in the production of goods, so for example the well-being of any person, always provide the agent with some reason to act or always make the action better or morally better. And secondly, if they claim that only the best or something close to the best is good enough, so you've got to get high up in the ranking in order to be acting morally permissibly. Now we should note 2 points. So firstly, what is distinctive about consequentialism is not that it asserts claim one. Many other theories will do that. What is distinctive about consequentialism is it says that these are the only factors that determine what we ought to do or what we have reason to do. And secondly, we should note that claim two is quite detachable from a consequentialist ranking of actions. There's no reason why consequentialists in particular should be tethered to this idea that only the best is good enough. Only actions at or near the top of their ranking of actions are morally required in order to be acting permissibly. So another way of putting this is to say that typical deontological theories differ from consequentialism in two main ways. So firstly, they recognise moral constraints on maximising the good, and secondly, they recognise moral options to fall short of maximising the good. A non-consequentialist theory which differs from consequentialism only in recognising moral constraints on maximising the good will still be extremely demanding if it says that we are morally required to maximise the good within those constraints. So there's no big difference there between consequentialist theories and non-consequentialist theories. And secondly, if the non-consequentialist theory also recognises moral options to fall short of maximising the good, there's nothing to stop the consequentialist, and by consequentialist there, I mean somebody who has a consequentialist ranking of actions, to say, okay, I'll be in your team and say that I'll deny that only the best is good enough to be acting morally permissibly. So consequentialists, by which I mean people with consequentialist rankings of action, can just as much as anyone else say, you don't need to perform the actions right at the top of the ranking in order to be acting morally permissibly. Okay, now some recent consequentialists or consequentialist sympathists in responding to demandingness objections have tried to detach their ranking of actions from this presumption of optimality, the idea that only the best is good enough. So they propose retaining the consequentialist ranking, but they deny MC, so the version of consequentialism that I provided all those objections to at the beginning of the talk. And I've mentioned the names of three theories on the handout which fall into that category: scalar consequentialism, satisfying consequentialism, and cost-sensitive consequentialism. And in the paper that I'm writing, I'm going to say more about each of them. I think the most plausible option for the consequentialist is going to be something called cost-sensitive consequentialism, which allows people to favour themselves to some degree over and above others. So you act morally permissibly even when you're giving yourself extra weight ahead of the well-being or the interests or concerns of other people. But I won't say more about that just now. So defenders of these theories deny that only the best is good enough, and they hope thereby to avoid demandingness objections, although they might end up facing other strong objections in light of their specific commitments. But there's no immediately apparent reason why consequentialists should be especially vulnerable to demandingness objections just because they endorse a particular ranking of actions, i.e. a ranking which is determined solely by the goodness of the consequences produced by those actions. So consequentialism as a ranking of actions is detachable from the problematic claim that only the best is good enough. If demandingness objections are good ones, then that need not be a decisive objection to consequentialism at all. Consequentialists can stick with their ranking of actions but give some other less demanding account of moral obligation. Okay, so perhaps consequentialists can develop a less demanding theory in response to demandingness objections, but as I said earlier, demandingness objections themselves have come under attack recently. So the rationale for demandingness objections that's generally proposed is that we cannot be required to live in a very self-sacrificial way because it's too costly to the agent. So theories which are implausibly demanding, like MC, impose unreasonably large costs on agents, according to people who make demandingness objections. So we might call that the appeal to cost. But critics of the demandingness objection, like David Sobel, for example, respond to this justification by pointing out that the costs to other people, for example, costs to the poor, of people's failing to live very self-sacrificial lives, are even greater. Once we take into account the costs for everyone concerned of different courses of action, not just the costs of the agent, a general appeal to cost seems therefore to speak in favour of a morality which requires people like us to live in a very self-sacrificial way after all. So it appears that demanding subjections rest on the thought that the correct moral theory cannot be one which allows some people to bear costs which are too great. But if that's correct, then theories which require less of agents like us, relatively privileged people in the developed world, which don't require us to devote all of our spare time and resources to helping the worst off, should be rejected because they allow the poor to continue to bear costs which are even larger than the ones that we bear if morality requires extreme devotion from us. So I've given an example in the handout that Sobel offers to try and get us thinking about this framework. So Joe has two healthy kidneys and can live a decent but reduced life with only one. Sally needs one of Joe's kidneys to live. Even though the transfer would result in a situation that's better overall, the demandingness objection's thought is it's asking so much of Joe to give up a kidney that he's morally permitted to not give. The size of the cost to Joe makes a purported moral demand that Joe give the kidney unreasonable, or at least not genuinely morally obligatory on Joe. Consequentialism, our intuitions tell us, is too demanding on Joe when it requires that he sacrifice a kidney to Sally. But consider things from Sally's point of view. Suppose she were to complain about the size of the cost that a non-consequentialist moral theory permit to befall her. Suppose she were to say that such a moral theory, in permitting others to allow her to die when they could aid her, is excessively demanding on her. Clearly, Sally has not fully understood how philosophers typically intend the demandingness objection. What has she failed to get about the objection? Why is it that consequentialism is too demanding on the person who would suffer significant costs if he was to aid others, as consequentialism, maximising that consequentialism, requires? But non-consequentialist morality, a less demanding morality as we would think of it, is not similarly too demanding on Sally, the person who would suffer more significant costs if she were not aided, as the alternative to consequentialism permits. What must the objection's understanding of the demands of a moral theory be, such that that would make sense? Okay, so that's the challenge that I'm trying to take on in my paper. So that whole line of thinking, it seems, threatens to disarm standard demandingness objections. So what are we to make of this critique of demandingness objections? There seems to be something plausible about the appeal to cost from proponents of the standard demandingness objection, as we saw at the beginning of the talk. But it seems they cannot just appeal to the general notion of the costliness of behaviour in order to defend the permissibility of ordinary behaviour. If the appeal to cost is just the claim that the costs which a theory allows some people to bear cannot be too high. So it seems clear that an appeal to cost that can ground typical demandingness objections must instead take the form that I've noted on the handout list at the very bottom of page 2. So the cost to the agent should not be too high. So if demandingness objections are to have any force, they're going to have to be built on the idea that cost to the agent in particular can stop someone from being morally required to do what it's morally best for her to do, and stop her from being morally required to bear whatever share of costs or burdens will result in the minimisation of overall costs and burdens. What could possibly explain such an asymmetry between the cost to agents and cost to others, in particular to the needy? Why is it that the cost to the agent, rather than to patients, to other people affected, and in particular the poor, should have so much influence in determining the extent of our moral obligations? Well, I think the answer has to be something like the costs to an agent count more because she's being required to impose them upon herself. So that's the second sentence of the appeal to agential costs there. I'm not totally convinced that this formulation is what I want, but that's what I've got just now. So it's implausible or unreasonable, so this view goes, to say that we're morally required to impose extreme costs upon ourselves. The view can't be that an account of moral requirements can be rejected if it results in some person, just any person, bearing great costs, or if the total costs are too high. Rather, the view must be that an account of moral requirements can be rejected if it results in some agent having to bring costs upon themselves. So why is that? What justifies this view? Well, I think this view is correct, and that it should be justified on the basis of the responsiveness of our reactive attitudes of blame and guilt and so on. So there's clearly a tight connection between what's morally obligatory and when someone is blameworthy, when they merit feelings of blame and feelings of guilt. But someone's not blameworthy simply for doing less than the most he could to help others. And the reason why we're not blameworthy and why it can't be morally wrong just to fail to do what's morally best, i.e. to live a very self-sacrificial life devoted to helping the worst off, is because we are creatures with a certain motivational profile. So we're predominantly self-interested, with only limited altruism, and much of the altruistic motivation that we do have is specifically concerned for those close to us, so our close kin and friends. And there's a tight connection between our moral sentimental reactions of blame, praise, admiration, which provide the basis of our best judgments of moral requirements and the typical levels of altruistic motivation that people have. So because people are typically predominantly self-interested, we judge someone who gives up, say, two nights a week and 30% of their income to helping the worst off to be really very admirable and not blameworthy. In saying that some course of action or lifestyle would be morally wrong or would violate a moral obligation, we say that someone would generally be blameworthy for acting in that way. But it would be completely inappropriate to blame someone for freely adopting a lifestyle like this, of substantial altruism and self-sacrifice, but one that's suboptimal. And we ought not to characterise as morally wrong acting in a way that it would really be morally admirable to act. So to see that there's no presumption of optimal behaviour in determining what our moral obligations are, I think it's useful to think about morality as a natural phenomenon, as something with a history. So our practice of making moral judgments, of praising and blaming, of holding people responsible, of shunning people, of imposing these informal sanctions of the sentiments on them for behaving in particular ways, all of that has a history, an evolutionary history. So these practices have developed in such a way that we most readily respond with the moral sentiments of blame to cases of harming, to cases of free-riding, non-cooperation. The likely evolutionary function of our blaming practices, of our negative moral reactions to certain types of behaviour, is to deter these sorts of antisocial behaviours. And our moral sentiments and our dispositions to make the moral judgments we do have evolved to deal with creatures with the sorts of motivational profiles that we do, predominantly self-interested, with only limited altruism. So we react with the sentiments of blame and morally condemn someone only when they're too selfish, when they fail to meet the standard or typical levels of altruism, rather than when they fail to do what's impartially optimal. Because these sentiments provide the grounding for our judgments of moral requirements and moral wrongness, a theory which strays too far from the verdicts of our natural sentimental responses, will inevitably strike us as unconvincing. So I think that's what's gone wrong in the case of MC. So I'll just draw some conclusions very quickly. So demanding this objections rest on an appeal to cost. Why is it that cost to agents and to patients are to be treated asymmetrically in the assessment of proper demands? Well, it's because agents are the ones who comply with demands. They're the ones that we're morally assessing. We're not assessing patients. Patients are not candidates for blame or for guilt, qua patients. Only agents are. And so in determining what an appropriate moral demand is on a particular agent, we've got to ask, would that agent merit feelings of blame and guilt for failing to impose a certain cost upon themselves, given their actual circumstances? So that's going to be our starting point in determining the extent of our moral obligations. Okay, I'll stop there.